Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into it, taking a long, structured look at someone truly remarkable in Hollywood. We're talking about Donald Frank Cheadle Jr., an actor known for just incredible versatility, strategic brilliance, and, well, a strong ethical compass.
Yeah, and the source material we have is it's incredibly detailed. We can really trace his whole path, you know, from doing mime shows back in high school.
Lots of mime shows, right.
Yeah, all the way to, well, the massive scale of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
So our mission here isn't just to, like, list off his movies.
No, definitely not.
No.
We want to unpack how. How does one person manage to get nominated for basically everything? Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony, that EGOT-y contender status.
Right.
And co-produce an Oscar Best Picture winner like Crash, give that unbelievably powerful performance in Hotel Rwanda,
which earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Actor.
Exactly. And still be the face of War Machine in one of the biggest franchises ever. It's kind of mind-blowing.
It really is the ultimate balancing act, isn't it? Between that high art, critically acclaimed stuff, and huge commercial success. And we really want to dig into how he pulled it off.
Okay, so before we dive deep, let's just lay out the basic facts for you. Born November 29th, 1964, Kansas City, Missouri.
And he got serious training early on, a BFA in theater from CalArts California Institute of the Arts back in 1986. That's a top school.
Absolutely. And beyond the acting and producing, which is, you know, undeniable, his humanitarian work is a huge part of his story. We'll definitely be covering that.
And personally, he married his longtime partner, Bridget Coulter, also an actress, in 2020. They'd been together for, what, almost 30 years?
Yeah, over 28 years before making it official. They have two kids together.
That kind of stability, you know, nearly three decades before actually marrying, that seems like it reflects his whole approach, doesn't it?
I think so. It suggests something really measured, long-term commitment. Like a solid foundation.
Right. A foundation strong enough to maybe let him take those big professional risks later.
Exactly. So to understand that, we need to go back. Look at what shaped him early on.
Okay. Let's unpack those early years because, as you said, our sources really emphasize how much they moved around.
Mm-hmm.
His dad was a clinical psychologist, his mom a teacher, professions that often mean relocating. And the family, Don, his sister Cindy, his brother Colin, they moved city to city.
That's right. We see him born in Kansas City. Then he's at Hartley Elementary in Lincoln, Nebraska for a few years, like 1970 to 74.
Okay.
And then he ends up graduating high school in Denver, Colorado, East High School, 1982.
Wow. That constant moving, you have to think, as a kid, that forces you to develop some serious skills.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Intense observation skills, right? And you've got to be adaptable.
Total. You're the new kid all the time. You learn to read the room fast.
You learn new social cues, how to connect with people quickly. All incredibly valuable skills for an actor who needs to transform to become different people. A real chameleon.
And his artistic side was already incredibly diverse back then. In Denver, at East High, he wasn't just, like, doing the school play.
No, the sources are specific. He was in musicals, straight plays. He played saxophone in the jazz band.
Okay.
Sang in choirs. And the detail that just jumps out.
And mime shows.
The mime shows, yeah. It's not something you typically see on the resume of an actor known for such, you know, verbal dexterity and dramatic intensity later on.
It seems almost counterintuitive.
Well, maybe not. If you think about what mime training involves, it's rigorous physical discipline. It's incredible control over facial expressions, even tiny ones. It's mastering storytelling without words.
Ah, okay. I see where you're going.
That kind of physical grounding, that nonverbal communication skill, that's exactly what underpins some of his most powerful dramatic work later, where so much is said with just a look or his posture. He learned that early.
So he takes all that varied training, the music, the acting, the mime, and heads to CalArts. Graduates in 86 with that BFA in theater.
Right. And it seems like he wasn't just, you know, waiting to get discovered by Hollywood. He was deep into the craft of theater itself.
He was doing serious stage work, even during college.
Yeah, during his CalArts years, the sources mention specific plays, really significant, often political stuff. Athol Fugard's work, like Master Harold and The Boys, The Island. Also, My Name Could Be Anne.
That's heavy material.
It is. It's intellectual. It's character focused. It tells you right away his sights were set on substance, not just, you know, fame.
But the screen work came pretty quickly after graduation. He got a SAG card almost right away, right?
Yeah, that first credited role was as a burger joint employee in a 1985 comedy, Moving Violations.
Huh, okay. Humble beginnings.
Got him the union card, though. That was the ticket. And then the professional grind really started.
And that early grind, looking at the dates, it's pure late 80s, early 90s TV and film.
Totally. 1987, he pops up in the final season of Hill Street Blues. Small role, playing a teenager with learning difficulties. Shows he could handle sensitive stuff early.
Same year, he's in Hamburger Hill, the Vietnam film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then Colors in 1988, playing Rocket. But yeah, the TV guest spots really show that shape-shifting ability.
Like Night Court in 88, playing a 16-year-old who's 23.
Exactly. He had that youthful look on screen, which definitely helps an actor, gives you wider casting range for longer.
But I think for a lot of people listening, the first time they really remember seeing him, it's got to be the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air in 1990.
Oh, absolutely. Ice Tray. Will Smith's friend from Philly? Kind of cool. Maybe a little bit dangerous for Bel-Air.
And Hilary Banks' first big love interest. That role needed serious charm and great comedic timing. He nailed it.
He really did. And that ability to handle comedy, to hold his own on a hit sitcom stage, it led directly to more regular TV work.
Right, because in 92, he lands a main role in that Golden Girls spinoff, The Golden Palace.
Yeah, playing Roland Wilson, the hotel manager. Mm-hmm. Young, kind of serious guy trying to wrangle the Golden Girls and Cheech Marin.
Quite the setup.
And this is where you really see that strategic balancing act starting to form. He's got this lead role in a network comedy spinoff that's a steady gig, right?
Yeah, good paycheck, visibility.
But at the same time, he wasn't abandoning drama. He also had a recurring role on Picket Fences.
Oh, wow. The David E. Kelly Show. Critically acclaimed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Playing District Attorney John Littleton for 3 seasons on that award-winning drama. So think about it. He's working 2 major network shows simultaneously. 1 comedy, 1 serious drama.
That's smart. Financial security, but also keeps his dramatic chops sharp.
It gives him freedom. He doesn't have to take roles later just for the money. That dual path. He established it right from the beginning.
Okay, so we've seen the foundation, the hustle, the early versatility. Now we move into the phase where he really breaks through critically. And the role everyone points to is Mouse Alexander in Devil in a Blue Dress, 1995.
Mouse.
Yeah.
That was pivotal. Because it wasn't just, oh, he's good in this. Mm. It was a star-making supporting turn.
He plays this trigger-happy friend of Denzel Washington's character. Kind of chilling, but also weirdly charismatic.
Totally. Menacing and charming all at once. And honestly, he stole scenes right out from under Denzel, who was already a huge star. Critics absolutely went wild for him. This is really the moment Cheadle becomes a critical darling.
And not just praised, but awarded. The sources highlight this specifically. He won Best Supporting Actor from 2 really prestigious groups, the LA Film Critics Association and the National Society of Film Critics.
And those aren't just popularity awards. That's serious critical recognition. Plus, he got nominations from SAG, the Actors Union, and the NAACP Image Awards.
So the signal to the industry was loud and clear. This guy is serious talent. Put him in quality films.
And the quality of his projects definitely jumped up right after that. He's in John Singleton's Rosewood in 97. That historical drama.
Same year, Volcano, the big disaster movie.
Right. And then, also in 97, he joins that incredible ensemble cast in Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights.
Wow. So he's moving between historical drama, blockbuster action, and auteur indie films. Seamlessly.
That versatility is just astonishing. And this whole era is really defined by the collaborators he starts working with. The most important one. Mm. Probably director Steven Soderbergh.
Yes. That partnership kicks off with Out of Sight in 1998. Great movie based on the Elmore Leonard novel.
Fantastic film. And that Soderbergh connection becomes absolutely key. Soderbergh is known for using this troupe of actors he trusts again and again across totally different kinds of movies.
Right. So once you're in that circle,
you get access, guaranteed access to interesting, high profile, critically respected material that worked together again really quickly on Traffic in 2000.
Another huge ensemble, multiple Oscar winner.
Yep. And much later, they reteamed for the period crime film No Sudden Move in 2021. That trust, built over decades, it allows an actor like Cheadle to take risks, knowing he has this artistic home base with a director who really gets him.
And that trust, that Soderbergh connection, it leads him right into one of the slickest, most successful franchises ever. The Ocean's movies.
The Ocean's 11 crew, yeah. In 2001, he joins that insane lineup. George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Andy Garcia, Julia Roberts.
And he's Basher Tarr, the Cockney explosives expert.
Basher Tarr. And, you know, we have to talk about the accent.
Yes. And the sources mentioned this. His Cockney accent in Ocean's 11, it's become kind of legendary for maybe not being entirely accurate.
Let's call it memorable, or maybe stylized. It's definitely a choice. And what's fascinating is that Soderbergh, the director, apparently just leaned into it.
He didn't try to fix it for the sequels.
No. They almost made it a running gag. It became part of Basher's quirky charm in Ocean's 12 and Ocean's 13.
That's actually pretty interesting. Why would an actor known for such careful preparation not quite nail an accent? Or was it like a deliberate caricature?
He apparently admitted later it was a tough accent to get right and maintain. But the fact that it stayed in the film and then kind of became this meta joke.
It says something about his status within that A-list group, right?
Exactly. He had built up enough trust and goodwill that a potential technical flaw just becomes an endearing character quirk.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that got him replaced. It got embraced.
While all this film success is happening, he's also just crushing it on television in really prestigious projects.
Oh, yeah. In 1998, he completely transforms himself to play Sammy Davis Jr. in the HBO movie The Rat Pack.
Huge undertaking, playing a legend like that.
And he was incredible. It earned him a Golden Globe win for Best Actor in a TV movie, plus an Emmy nomination.
Right.
Major validation.
Winning a Globe for embodying Sammy Davis Jr., that's huge. And then just a year later, he follows it up with another really significant TV role.
Right, starring in A Lesson Before Dying in 1999. Based on the Ernest J. Gaines novel, an Emmy-winning TV movie, he played the school teacher, Grant Wiggins.
So he's showing he can carry these important literary adaptations, these heavy dramatic roles on TV, too.
And even when he just did guest spots, they were high impact. Season 9 of ER, which was still a massive show.
Yeah.
He guessed as Paul Nathan, a medical student dealing with Parkinson's disease. Really demanding role, emotionally complex.
And that got him an Emmy nomination, too, right, for guest actor in a drama series in 2003.
Yep. So you see this pattern solidifying, whether it's a lead role, a supporting part, a movie, a TV show, even a guest spot. The result is almost always critical acclaim, awards attention. He just maximized every single opportunity.
Okay, so the career momentum keeps building, but the focus seems to shift here. We're moving from being part of great ensembles to delivering these singular, really defining dramatic performances, performances with global resonance.
Yeah, and we absolutely have to spend some time on Hotel Rwanda. 2004.
Playing Paul Rusabajena, the hotel manager who sheltered and saved over 1,200 refugees during the Rwandan genocide in 1994.
Just unbelievable story. And the role itself is just a crucible, psychologically, emotionally. Cheadle had to convey not just men's bravery, but also the terror, the desperation, the sheer weight on this one man.
The preparation must have been immense, carrying the weight of that history, that tragedy, through one individual's experience.
And the world recognized it. The performance earned him that Academy Award nomination for Best Actor, his first Oscar nomination. That really cemented him as a major dramatic force on a global scale.
Now, this is where his career strategy gets really fascinating, like you said earlier. The very next year, 2005, he doesn't just act in another important film, he produces one.
Right. Crash. That ensemble drama exploring race and class tensions in Los Angeles, he was both a star in the film and a co-producer.
Let's unpack that co-producer credit. That's not just a title they slap on for stars sometimes, right? This implies real involvement.
It definitely implies more than just showing up to act. It suggests he was involved in the decision-making, creative decisions, maybe financial aspects. Taking on that producer role means you want more control.
So what was the strategic intent there, do you think?
Well, it signals ambition beyond just performing. It says, I want to shape the narrative. By producing a film like Crash, which was challenging, multi-layered, not an easy sell, he's showing he wants to champion certain kinds of stories.
And taking a risk.
A big risk, but it paid off massively. When Crash famously won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 2006.
Upsetting Brokeback Mountain.
That very controversial win, yes. Cheadle shared in that Best Picture Oscar as a producer. That's huge. An Oscar-winning producer on top of being a nominated actor.
His acting in Crash wasn't overlooked either. He got Best Supporting Actor nominations from BAFTA and the Screen Actors Guild for that role.
So he's firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
Acting, producing, tackling really significant issue-driven films.
After those two incredibly intense dramas, Hotel Rwanda and Crash, he mixes it up again. Strategically.
Yeah, he pivots. Stars with Adam Sandler in Rain Over Me in 2007. It's a comedy drama directed by Mike Binder about a man dealing with loss after 9/11.
Interesting pairing, Cheadle and Sandler. How did that film do?
Critically, it got some decent notices for its sensitivity, but our sources point out it didn't really connect to the box office. Made about $22 million domestically.
That's important context. It shows that even with big stars, difficult subject matter can be a tough sell commercially.
True. But a box office stumble like that didn't seem to slow him down at all. He starred in the thriller Traitor the next year, 2008.
And he even did a family film, Hotel for Dogs, in 2009.
Right. The sheer variety is key. He just refuses to be put in a box. Prestige drama, check. Commercial thriller, check. Family movie, check.
He was also trying to move into directing around this time, wasn't he?
He was. Had plans to adapt another Elmore Leonard novel, Tishomingo Blues. But yeah, as you mentioned earlier, that project kind of fell apart, declared dead in 2007.
A good reminder that even for someone with his talent and clout, getting projects made, especially directing, is always a battle in Hollywood.
Definitely. Now, this seems like a good point to pull back and look at the bigger picture of his awards recognition, because it really highlights his strategy and his range. We mentioned EGOT earlier.
Right. The quest for the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. Very few people even get nominated for all four.
And Cheadle is remarkably close. He's actually won 3 out of the 4 categories. Let's just quickly break it down for you, because how he won them is really telling.
Okay, first, the Oscar. That Best Actor nomination for Hotel Rwanda, the peak of his dramatic film work.
Then, the Tony Award. He got that win in 2022, but crucially, not for acting on stage. He won as a producer for the musical A Strange Loop, which won Best Musical.
So that producer credit strategy paid off on Broadway, too. Creative control again.
Exactly. Now, the Grammys. He has 2 wins, and they are fascinatingly diverse. First one, 2016 Best Compilation Soundtrack for Visual Media for Miles Ahead.
His passion project about Miles Davis. So he won a Grammy for the music of the film he directed, wrote, produced, and starred in.
Incredible. The second Grammy came in 2022 for Best Spoken Word Album. He narrated the audiobook Carry On, Reflections for a New Generation from John Lewis.
Wow. So that win connects directly to his commitment to civil rights and social justice. Even his voice work is tied to these bigger themes.
It's amazing. And finally, the Emmys. Television is where he has just been a constant presence, racking up nominations.
How many total?
11 primetime Emmy nominations over the years. Think about The Range, The Rat Pack, A Lesson Before Dying, Things Behind the Sun, that ER guest spot we talked about.
Plus his later series work.
Right, House of Lies, Black Monday, and even his recent appearance in the Marvel series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Nominations across decades, genres, formats.
And don't forget the Golden Globes. He won 2 of those.
Right. One for playing Sammy Davis Jr. in The Rat Pack, pure drama. And another one later for his comedy series, House of Lies.
So if you take one thing away from this period, it's not just that he's versatile. It's that he achieves excellence, recognized excellence, across almost every medium and genre imaginable. Biography, crime, comedy, franchise.
It's systematic excellence. And that perfectly sets the stage for what comes next.
Exactly. This sustained excellence, this ability to deliver across the board, it prepared him perfectly for the absolute global spotlight of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is the decade he becomes James Rhodey Rhodes' war machine.
And the way he entered the MCU is itself a fascinating story in strategic navigation. He took over the role in Iron Man 2. Back in 2010.
Replacing Terrence Howard, who had played Rhodey in the first Iron Man.
Right. And stepping into an established role like that, especially in a franchise already blowing up, that's tricky. There's a lot of pressure.
Oh, I remember the fan discussion, the articles. There was definitely noise around that recasting. He had to make the character his own immediately for an audience that already had an idea of Rhodey.
And he did it brilliantly, I think. He brought this grounded, serious, almost weary professionalism to Rhodey that was the perfect counterpoint to Tony Stark's brilliant chaos.
Yeah, a believable military man, a sense of duty and gravity amidst all the high-flying tech and aliens.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And just look at how central he became. The list of appearances is huge. Iron Man 2, Iron Man 3, where he gets the Iron Patriot suit for a bit.
Right.
Avengers, Age of Ultron, Captain America. Civil War, Avengers, Infinity War, that quick cameo in Captain Marvel, and then the massive finale, Avengers, Endgame.
And he's still very much part of the MCU fabric. He got an Emmy nomination for just a brief appearance in the Falcon and the Winter Soldier series on Disney Plus 4.
Yeah, which is kind of amazing. He also voiced Rhodey in the animated What If series and played a major role in the recent Secret Invasion series in 2023.
And the commitment continues. He's set to lead his own Marvel project, the film Armor Wars.
Which is significant because that was originally announced as a Disney Plus series, but they upgraded it to a theatrical movie. That suggests Marvel really believes in his ability to anchor a big screen feature.
So the MCU gives him this incredible global platform, financial security.
Which you have to assume allows him the freedom to pursue those other maybe less commercial passion projects.
Yeah.
It's that balance again.
Totally. Because while he's literally saving the world in billion-dollar blockbusters, he's also starring in and winning awards for really sharp, complex comedy on premium cable.
Right. From 2012 to 2016, he starred as Marty Kayan in House of Lies on Showtime.
Ruthless management consultant, super fast-talking, ethically dubious, incredibly charismatic.
A completely different skill set from War Machine or, you know, Paul Russo Vagina. High-speed satire, breaking the fourth wall, navigating moral gray areas with this relentless energy.
And that pivot worked. He won the Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Comedy Series in 2013 for Marty Kayan,
solidifying his place in that prestige cable comedy world. And he followed it up later with Black Monday, another cable comedy, from 2019 to 2021.
Playing Maurice Monroe, that outlandish 80s financial guru, got more Emmy nominations for that one, too.
Yeah. The ability to just shift gears from global tragedy in Hotel Rwanda to, like, Wall Street satire in Black Monday.
Yeah.
And be totally convincing in both. That's rare air.
But throughout this whole massive Marvel comedy TV phase, there was one project bubbling under the surface. The big personal one.
Miles Ahead. The Miles Davis film. Released in 2016. And this project really embodies his drive for creative control. For bringing a specific vision to life.
Because this wasn't just another acting job. Our sources say he worked on this for a decade.
At least. Writing it, getting the funding, producing it, directing it, and starring as Miles Davis, he wore all the hats.
Why did it take so long? What were the big hurdles?
Well, creative vision was a big one. Apparently, Miles Davis's estate initially wanted a more traditional cradle-to-grave biopic.
But Cheadle had a different idea.
Yeah, he wanted something much more unconventional, non-linear, impressionistic, focusing on a specific period, capturing the feel of Miles's music and personality, that restless energy, not just hitting the biographical bullet points.
So he had to fight for that vision.
And fight for the money. Independent film funding is always tough, especially for something that isn't a straightforward genre piece. He really had to use the clout he'd built up from Marvel, from House of Lies, to finally get Miles Ahead made the way he wanted.
And as we mentioned, the soundtrack for that film earned him one of his Grammys. So the dedication paid off in multiple ways.
Absolutely. Looking at his work just in the last few years, that strategic diversity just keeps going. 2021, he reunites with Soderbergh for No Sudden Move.
Right, that period crime thriller, playing a gangster in 1950s Detroit.
Yeah.
Kind of echoes back to Mouse Alexander in a way.
Yeah, a return to those cool, dangerous characters. But then, same year, completely different direction. He plays the main villain in Space Jam. A new legacy.
LG Rhythm, the evil computer algorithm.
I mean, talk about range. From 1950s gangster to a digital bad guy opposite LeBron James and Bugs Bunny.
And he even did voice work for the DuckTales reboot.
Providing Donald Duck's temporary electronic voice box. It's just fun, shows his willingness to play.
And the future looks just as busy and varied. We've got Armor Wars coming in the MCU.
But outside of Marvel, he's in a new Peacock crime drama miniseries called Fight Night, The $1 Million Heist. Set around Muhammad Ali's comeback fight in 1970. That's coming to 2024.
He also co-starred in a film called Unstoppable this year, a biographical drama about a wrestler.
Playing the coach, Sean Charles. And maybe the most interesting upcoming project, bringing his career full circle.
His Broadway debut.
Planned for 2026. He's set to star in a revival of Proof, the Pulitzer Prize-winning play by David Auburn.
Wow. After all the success in film and TV, he's still pushing himself, going back to the stage for a major challenging role. It's incredible. We've spent a lot of time on his incredible career path, the acting, the producing, the versatility. But you really can't talk about Don Cheadle without diving into his activism. It's arguably just as defining as his work on screen.
I completely agree. It's not just, you know, occasional charity appearances. It's deep, sustained, strategic engagement on major global issues. Especially his work around the genocide in Darfur and the aftermath in Rwanda, which was clearly spurred by his experience making Hotel Rwanda.
It seems like that film was a catalyst. He realized the platform he had and felt a moral obligation to use it.
Exactly. He didn't just lend his name. He got involved in policy. He spearheaded campaigns aimed at ending the genocide in Darfur, Sudan, really trying to mobilize international action.
And this led him to actually co-author a book on the subject, right?
Yeah. Not on our watch. The Mission to End Genocide in Darfur and Beyond. He wrote that with activist John Prendergast. But maybe even more significantly, he co-founded an organization.
A Not On Our Watch project.
Right. The whole idea was to use high-profile visibility to focus global attention and, critically, resources on preventing mass atrocities.
Hmm.
Not just reacting, but trying to prevent them.
And the co-founders list is basically a who's who of Hollywood power players who also cared about this.
Seriously. George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, producer Jerry Weintraub, human rights lawyer David Pressman. That's immense collective star power.
And the goal wasn't just fundraising, was it? It was about leverage.
It was strategic leverage. Using their fame to force media coverage, to get politicians to pay attention to crises that might otherwise fly under the radar.
And this work got recognized pretty quickly on a global stage.
Oh, yeah. 2007 was a big year. He got the BE Humanitarian Award. And then, alongside George Clooney, he received the Summit Peace Award, presented by Nobel Peace Prize laureates themselves in Rome, specifically acknowledging their work on Darfur.
He even found ways to combine his activism with other interests, like poker.
Huh? Yeah. He co-organized that charity poker tournament, Anti-Up for Africa, with the poker pro Annie Duke, raising money for Darfur relief efforts. And he kept the policy focus going, too, writing a second book with Prendergast in 2010.
The Enough Moment. Fighting to end Africa's worst human rights crimes. He stayed committed.
Deeply. And his activism wasn't limited to just humanitarian crises. He also took on environmental issues in a big way.
Right. In 2010, he became a UN Environment Program Goodwill Ambassador, focusing on climate change.
And that led to him co-creating that documentary series, Years of Living Dangerously, with Harrison Ford.
That was a really effective series, wasn't it? Because it wasn't just statistics.
No, it focused on the human impact. They had correspondents, including Cheadle himself, reporting from the front lines of climate change, showing how it affects real people's lives. He's also on the advisory board for the Citizens Climate Lobby, still active in policy.
And he's shown he's willing to make personal statements, too, like during his Saturday Night Live hosting gig in 2019.
Yeah, wearing that T-shirt that said Protect Trans Kids,
mm-hmm.
using that huge platform for a very clear, specific message of support.
Okay, so beyond the activism, there's some really fascinating personal history that adds another layer to understanding him. His family background was explored in that PBS series, African American Lives 2, back in 2008.
And the findings were incredibly complex, historically speaking. It turned out that some of Cheadle's ancestors were actually enslaved by members of the Chickasaw Nation, not by white Southerners.
That's a part of American history that isn't widely discussed.
Not at all. After the Civil War, the U.S. government required the so-called five civilized tribes, which included the Chickasaw, to free the people they had enslaved. These individuals became known as the freedmen, like the Chickasaw freedmen.
But it wasn't straightforward emancipation, was it?
No. The Chickasaw Nation resisted granting full citizenship rights to the freedmen for a long time. So Cheadle's ancestors, even after being freed around 1866, they didn't actually gain U.S. or Chickasaw citizenship until the 1890s.
Because of the Dawes Commission and all that complex federal negotiation with the tribes.
Exactly. So think about that. For decades after the Civil War ended, his ancestors were essentially stateless, caught in this incredibly complicated intersection of tribal sovereignty, federal policy, and the legacy of slavery within indigenous nations.
Knowing that history, that family struggle for basic rights and recognition, it definitely adds depth to understanding his passion for human rights advocacy today. It's personal.
It has to be. The DNA tests from that show were also interesting. They showed Cameroonian ancestry. But more broadly, his African heritage traced back to regions from Senegal down to Liberia, the Congo-Angola area, and also Western Nigeria and Benin. A real tapestry.
And just to wrap up the personal side, that relationship with Bridget Coulter, being together for 28 years, raising two children, and then getting married in 2020.
It speaks volumes about stability, right? Having that solid personal foundation through all the chaos and demands of a Hollywood career, that kind of bedrock probably gave him the security and freedom to take the creative and political risks he's taken.
It seems like a really crucial piece of the puzzle. Hashtag tag out UTRO. So let's try and bring this all together for you. We've traced Don Cheadle's journey, really a masterclass in strategic career building, starting with that diverse foundation mime, jazz, serious theater.
Yeah, then breaking through critically with that unforgettable intensity, A Devil in a Blue Dress, reaching that dramatic summit with Hotel Rwanda and the Oscar nomination.
And then strategically leveraging that acclaim to gain power behind the camera, becoming an Oscar-winning producer for Crash.
And he used that hard-won authority brilliantly.
Yeah.
Balancing the massive financial stability and global reach of being War Machine in the MCU.
Right.
With the creative control needed to pour his heart into a decade-long passion project like Miles Ahead.
Mm-hmm.
His whole career is just this stunning refusal to pick a lane. Excellence in comedy, drama, crime, blockbusters.
And crucially, as we saw, he never walled off his art from his purpose. He consistently channels the fame, the platform, the capital from his acting career directly into serious systematic activism.
Through Not On Our Watch, through his books, his UN work. It's clear he sees his career not just as a job, but as a tool for advocacy, for trying to make a tangible difference on issues he cares deeply about.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you to mull over. We've established just how deeply Cheadle integrates his ethical perspective, his history of activism on things like genocide and climate change, into his life and work. So think about this. He's now preparing to lead a Marvel movie, Armor Wars. The core idea of that story is about advanced weapons technology specifically. Tony Stark's Iron Man tech falling into the wrong hands. Potential for mass destruction, misuse of power.
Right. Classic superhero stakes.
But given who Don Cheadle is, the actor, the producer, the co-founder of Not On Our Watch, how might he approach that? How will his perspective influence that narrative? Could he bring a sharper, maybe more cautionary, ethical, or even political layer to this story about dangerous tech proliferation than your typical blockbuster might explore?
Will War Machine's next mission be as much about global ethics as it is about stopping bad guys? It's definitely something to think about.
Something to consider until our next deep dive.